It's not as though CEOs, board members, leadership completely disregards people. It's simply the fact that in that due diligence, the majority of the time, the focus is on getting the deal done. You know, running the numbers, finding the business value story. What's that going to be and how do we get there? And I get that. I'm not even trying to go against that. I simply wanted to, through both my book and the speaking and consulting that I do, to help leaders be better prepared. I found that consistently leaders just underestimate how difficult it is for people to pivot and to change as quickly as leadership expects.
Spreading the word about the incredibly innovative leaders that live next door. That's what we do here at The Practical Optimist. The M&A whisperer and aspiring ambassador to France, the business trailblazer. These are just a few of the titles bestowed upon today's guest, Jennifer Fondrevet, a world-renowned speaker and author on all things related to the human side of corporate combinations. Jennifer is known for the 10 employee personas that she created and illustrated in her book about what happens to employees after a company is acquired or sold. But her expertise and business mindset extends far beyond the M&A world. The daughter of a fashion model and a French businessman, Jennifer grew up in an international household that was grounded in drive, ambition, a lot of humor, and a great deal of humility. I'm your host, Ken Schmidt, founder and CEO of Turning Point Executive Search and author of The Practical Optimist, which I'm very happy to say is available online and at your local bookstore. So pick up a copy today. Today's discussion is sure to bring a smile to your face while changing your perspective on what's happening behind the curtain of mergers and acquisitions and the fast-changing business landscape. So sit back and prepare to be entertained as Jennifer Fondrevet takes us through the intersection of leadership and life. Thank you so much for being with us this morning, Jennifer. I'm very excited about our conversation about the whole world around exit strategies and M&A and all the things that go along with that. So today I'm joined by Jennifer Fondrevet. She is known as the M&A Whisperer. She is the author of a really cool book that I read right after I saw her speak the first time at an ACG national conference. And the book is called Now What? Focusing on how you can thrive through an M&A exit. So welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm really impressed that you're excited to talk about exit strategies and mergers and acquisitions. We're going to get along.
Yes, exactly right. Well, being, I think, an executive search for 26 years also and seeing so many changes and so much is around human capital, right? And I think, you know, that's one of the things that you and I talked about when we first, you know, said hello and shook hands at that first conference was right. That, you know, so much of exit strategies and M&A, that whole ecosystem is focused around financials. That's why they're doing it, right? And the human capital side really gets lost in the conversation. So I think that's why we click so much from the very beginning.
Definitely. Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. And you're right. It can get forgotten.
Very much so. So you're coming to us from your new home out there in outside of Phoenix in Arizona. So, you know, welcome to the western part of the U.S.
Well, let's not talk about the weather too much, because if you have listeners from the Midwest or the East Coast, they will turn this off right now. So we won't talk about the weather.
Exactly. Although we complained about a drought for 7 years here in Southern California, and now we're complaining we've got 5 months of just nonstop rain. So yeah, the beauty is in the eye of the beholder. I guess weather in this point, this stage, exactly. So I agree. So let's kind of jump into our conversation today. We have a lot to get to, a lot of great conversation pieces to really focus on. So I want to start with, you know, I'm curious, going back to the early days, did you see yourself kind of getting to a point where you had your own business, where you were focusing mainly on being an author and a global speaker and being that consultant that you are today?
Absolutely not. No plan to do what I'm doing now. In fact, I'm pretty astonished that I do what I do now, but I can say with 100% confidence that I'm doing what I was always meant to do. I just didn't know it. Because my original, and I think we may have chatted about this, my original big, hairy, audacious goal was to be ambassador to France.
That's a very specific goal.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, I'm sure we'll talk about it later.
Yeah, exactly.
My father, who's French, still holds out hope You know, I just say I'm taking a circuitous path. But really, the genesis of what I do now came from going through three separate multi-billion dollar acquisitions. I'd been on all sides. I'd been acquired, part of acquirer. I'd been acquired by private equity. And by that third acquisition experience, I just kept thinking, God, there's got to be a better way to do M&A, a way in which the people piece of the deal transaction isn't secondary, that the people strategy is defined up front. And I just didn't see that happening, right? I mean, you've seen the statistic, I'm sure, as well as your listeners, right? 70 to 90% of mergers and acquisitions fail. Fail meaning they don't achieve their value, you know, by year one. And I thought, okay, well, I've got to be part of solving that problem. So originally, I just planned to write the book, Now What? But life took on a different turn. You know, it turned out that more than the book was needed.
As they say, life is what happens when you're making plans, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm a poster child for that.
That's great. Well, and so you started your career in the traditional, you know, quote unquote, traditional advertising space with, you know, a couple of really big firms, including J. Walter Thompson, which, you know, is really one of the, it's the J&J and the Xerox and the IBM, right, of the advertising and marketing space. How did you decide to go that route, you know, early on in your career?
Are you meaning like I can, the question underneath that is, how is that going to get you to ambassador?
Exactly. Right. Do they have an office in France? Maybe. Do they have a connection with the politics?
I'm on to you. Okay. I went to Thunderbird. I went to Thunderbird International Business School, number one international business school, again, with the intent of becoming ambassador to France. And thank God I had a really good, thoughtful professor, who was marketing research, who said to me, so what is it you want to do when you graduate? And I said, ambassador to France. And he looked at me and he just said, that's great. Right. And now I know, looking back, he's probably thinking, thankfully he said to me, I think that's wonderful. And if anyone could do it, Jennifer, you could, but I would have a backup plan, like, you know, just to have a plan B. And, I think you have an affinity for marketing. Yeah, you should consider coursework that I did, INTERAD, which is International Advertising Program. And through that experience, we had an opportunity to present to a suite of really high-level advertising executives. And I got my job through that program. Thank goodness. It detoured me from the whole ambassadorship, but I'm thankful for it. Because he didn't say this, but I know what he was thinking is, you're more likely to become ambassador to France if you just make a lot of money, support a candidate who becomes president, and then appoints you ambassador to France. So that's the path I'm taking now.
Exactly. And there was no class at Thunderbird that taught you that that route, that path to ambassadorship.
No, there was not.
Yeah. So at what point, and maybe it wasn't a definitive point, maybe it was kind of gradual, but was there a point that you recall thinking, okay, the ambassadorship, maybe that's something that I could do later on as a quasi-retirement type of a role? Did it eventually take a formal backseat to where you've gotten to today?
Well, it's what's interesting. So I love the marketing and advertising classes that I took at graduate school, and then having the opportunity to do that INTERAD program, get exposure to ad executives, meet with them, and then being in advertising, it just naturally, it wasn't a conscious effort, but it took a bit of a back seat, simply in that I loved what I did. I'm a very right and left brain person. I was in account work, but I really loved the creative side of advertising. And I was really good at helping bridge between what my creative team could come up with, you know, because advertising, success in advertising is about the big idea. What is the big idea? And then how do you execute it? And I was really good at helping them foster that big idea, sell it in, and then execute. And the, I guess the irony of it all is that I did kind of fulfill my ambassador to France experience when I went to NAFTEC, Navigation Technologies, digital mapping company. So I switched over to the marketing side and was the head of marketing in France. So I lived in Europe for 3 years. And so that kind of that scratched that itch of being. So I did it kind of indirectly that way.
Well, that's great. Wow. So you had a chance to be over there. And now I know your father was French, obviously, or is French. Did you do much traveling, or was that the first time you had actually stepped foot in the country that you hopefully wanted to be the ambassador for?
No. My quest to be ambassador was because as a little kid throughout my life, thankfully, my mom wanted me to maintain my French language and culture. So every summer I went and spent time with my grandmother in France. My sister and I both did. And I, to this day, I'm enormously grateful. My only regret is that we didn't speak French with my father when I was younger. It was thanks to my grandmother. But fluency in French is what helped me get that job with NAVTEQ. Being able to go over to France, understand the culture was incredibly important to my success at the beginning. So I'm thankful that my parents were very focused on making sure that I maintained that side of, who I was.
Sure. Now, and did you have any international, French or otherwise international clients that you worked with when you were still at J. Walter Thompson? Or was the international business exposure, did that really begin with NAVTEQ?
Yeah. So what's interesting is while I was working at J. Walter Thompson, I worked on Chiclets chewing gum. I don't know if you remember Chiclets chewing gum, the little.
Oh, yeah. 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 Exactly. Right.
Phenomenal product. At the time, it was Warner Lambert, got it acquired by Pfizer. All of the brands I've worked on have all been acquired at some point, which is kind of fascinating to me. But Chiclets chewing gum was the number one chewing gum in the world. If you just took the US out, right, South America, Europe, even Asia. And so I had the opportunity to work on the international ad campaign for Chiclets. We filmed in Rio, in Brazil. And for a while, my father was convinced that I was going to just run off and, marry a Brazilian and never come back to the United States. But amazing, amazing experience. I loved working in South America. But that working on international ad campaigns was a great way for me to kind of fulfill that international aspect of what I wanted to do in my career.
Well, it's funny. I know I'm kind of jumping around a little bit, but I'm curious about your book. So I know that when I wrote my book, I've always been a really big fan of journaling, right? Probably because my wife is a therapist, and so whenever I'm stressing her out, she's like, "Hey, write this down," right? So I'm a big fan of journaling.
It's very cathartic. It's a great habit to have.
It's amazing, and good times and bad times. It's not just a matter of try to process things when you're working through something in your head, right? But also, hey, this thing went well, or this is a success, or this is a surprise success. Let me actually jot it down so I can remember it down the road. But I bring it up because it took me a while of being a business owner for 16 years and a lot of journaling and a lot of experience before I even really thought about writing a book. Did you start to think earlier on? Did you do anything did you have a kind of a journal or the equivalent of an iPhone notes page back then when you were overseas in France?
No, thankfully, in my first acquisition experience, that's when NAVTEQ was acquired by Nokia. I went through a lot. I found that when you've never gone through an acquisition, there's a lot of unexpected surprises, which is what I reflect in my book. But at the time when you're going through it, it just can be destabilizing. So I'd have to say it was at that point that I thought about writing a book because I couldn't find a book that reflected what I was going through. And I just thought, am I the only one that has ever had this feeling of being destabilized? Then went to my next company. That team that I inherited had been acquired. And I was a better leader to them because I knew exactly what they were going through. I knew what they were thinking. One guy even said, for a while I thought you were a witch because you just seemed to always read our minds and know what we were thinking. And then by my third acquisition, I'd had enough leaders over time who would say, you should write a book. Like you just seem to understand it. It's a different leadership toolkit right? When you're dealing with change and uncertainty almost on a constant daily basis, it's not your standard toolkit, right? And there's different tools. So not only is it a different toolkit, there's different tools in it. And so it was really as a result of that experience, having been on all sides, and having enough people say, you really should write a book about it, that I started to think about it. Where the advertising part of me plays in is I had the idea that the book, I thought, who in their right mind is going to read a book about mergers and acquisitions? Like when you're in it, you're not thinking about books. You're just thinking about survival, right? I mean, I'm going to be blunt. So I thought, okay, no one's going to want this book unless they thought it really reflected and might be funny. So it's a satirical business book and it's illustrated. You know, I have 10 personas. They're caricatures. I illustrate the stages of grief, you know, what it's like to get from denial to acceptance. I wanted to be very matter of fact and upfront. And I credit my advertising. That's why I said to you at the beginning, I had no plan to do this. I had no idea I would be doing this, but I can see that my career led to what I do now, because I wouldn't have come up with the book idea and the, you know, desire to illustrate it had it not been for that exposure to creativity earlier in my career.
No, exactly. Well, and that's one of the things I think that really resonated with me when I heard you speak, but also, you know, when I read the book, is that, you know, because M&A is just, you know, what comes to mind is not 10 caricatures of different, you know, personas and people, right? It doesn't invoke, you know, the thought of you know, drawings and illustrations and humor by any stretch of the imagination. It's a very linear, very serious, very intense kind of endeavor, right? And so I like the fact that you brought that humor and that sense of you know, kind of humanity, if you will, to what is a very linear, very, you know, stoic kind of a conversation typically.
But you hit on it. That's why I approached it that way. I wanted the book to feel like I was sitting on the bar stool next to you, you know, and I'd ordered us a pint and I was going to give you everything I knew about how to not just survive through this period in your career, but how to thrive. You know, I wanted to highlight that there are opportunities. You don't always see them because you're fixated on trying to preserve the past. And I will absolutely say that was my journey. And thankfully, though, after going through three of them, I thought, okay, there is a way to do this, and there's a way to get through it, and to not only get through it, but to create your new career, your new path. And so that's what I fixated on, and then the caricatures were really to bring out the humanity aspect, exactly as you said, to highlight that it's people, right? People are what make the company thrive or die. And I just found too often they became secondary to the focus of the deal transaction.
So with all the experience that you have, having gone through three, obviously, M&A activities or transactions on your own, and then now being a consultant and you're seeing this on a regular basis, it's probably, there's no one answer, but what is it that causes people to continue to do this activity when, like you said, 70 to 80% of the activities fail? Right? It just seems so counterintuitive. And I know it's, you know, there's some hubris involved and ego at times also. The fact that you can say, oh, yes, I acquired ABC company. But do you have a sense for why it is that this continues to happen and that the number of failures isn't decreasing? I mean, if it was down to maybe 50% today when it was 90% 20 years ago, all right, at least we're heading in the right direction. But all the things that I read out there, including your book, say that it really hasn't moved the needle at all.
Right. Now, this is not to say, because obviously, right, so the 70 to 90%, McKinsey, Harvard, it's a consistent stat and data point. There are, particularly, I think, private equity starting to get smarter, like, you know, growing portfolios, really allowing companies to thrive and focus. But what I wanted to address is exactly that, right? How do we reduce that 70%, even to get to 50%? Right. And I thought what I had experienced was that lack of attention to the people. And what I would say is I never felt that it was intentional. It's not as though CEOs, board members, leadership completely disregards people. It's simply the fact that in that due diligence, the majority of the time, the focus is on getting the deal done, you know, running the numbers, finding the, the business value story. What's that going to be and how do we get there? And I get that. I'm not even trying to go against that. I simply wanted to, through both my book and the speaking and consulting that I do, to help leaders be better prepared. I found that consistently leaders just underestimate how difficult it is for people to pivot and to change as quickly as leadership expects. You can write the objectives and strategies and have your new metrics, but it takes people a while to pivot. And I always say, think about what we experienced with the pandemic. I mean, think about how difficult it was for the entire world to accept things have completely changed and they are never going back to the way they were. You know, we now joke it's the new normal, but they're never going back to the way they were. And it takes a while to embrace and understand that. And everybody got to acceptance at a different rate of that. So I say, just if you use that as your reference point, recognize that the same thing is going to happen within your organization. There will be some people who are so excited. They were at acceptance the moment they heard about the deal, right?
Yeah, they're ready to embrace it and let's move forward. I'm excited. Let's make it happen, right?
Right. Then, and I will say it tends to be, through my research, the majority of the workforce, they're waiting to see, like, what is this? What are the new metrics? Because again, they're attached to the past. Their livelihood, their self-worth, their value is based on those achievements. And now suddenly you're telling them, It's a different way forward, and they don't know what that is. It's why I write about the stages of grief. Many times I saw a workforce, and I experienced it myself, when you've identified with your company very strongly and passionately, that's what makes you a good employee. And now suddenly I'm telling you, well, no, that's not what this, it's and this came through a conversation I had with the CEO. His mother was a grief counselor, and he was describing to her what he was seeing his organization go through. And she said, well, your workforce is mourning the future that won't be. They're grieving the future that they had anticipated that now will likely not happen. And I thought it was a brilliant way of articulating what a workforce can go through. And so for me, I don't think it's ever intentional that people are forgotten. They just become secondary because getting the deal done becomes the focus. And so that's why I compliment other consulting work by saying, okay, here's the emotions, this is what drives them, and here's how you can do a better job of not only making people still front and center in your strategy, but actually being a better leader through times of change and uncertainty.
It's interesting. We recently launched a new HR solution, strategic HR solutions practice, as part of Turning Point. And one of the things that I'm constantly talking about with our practice director, also named Jennifer, is the fact that, and she comes from a 20 plus years of HR experience. And we talk a lot about, you know, the importance of HR having a strategic role along with the other senior executives and executive leadership team at any company, any size, whatever the industry might be, and that it's a struggle. Right. And she had a great point. She said, nobody says, oh, VP of sales, we got to make sure that the VP of sales, you know, has a seat at the table. Right. No one says that. It's assumed. But you hear it all the time about HR. HR, we got to work hard and really fight to make sure that HR has a seat at the table. And her point is, you know, HR should de facto have a seat at the table. It shouldn't be an initiative, right, or a goal. It should be, you know, a given. And I think what you're talking about with human capital and the big miss when it comes to M&A is that, you know, HR as the de facto leader of people, right, of culture, that person is not involved in the M&A conversations until after the fact. And it's like, okay, great. Here's your new state of people. You got 50, 100, 1,000 new people, you know, make it work. Make sure all the cultures are gelled together. Good luck. Right. But it's an after the fact conversation.
Yeah, consistently. And what's funny is, cause my background is, you know, marketing, advertising, we've talked about that, but I've had so many HR leaders who I've worked with in the past who hear and listen to me on podcasts and webinars who say, I always knew you were a closet HR person, right?
I love it. I love it.
Because I do highlight, and here's what I perceive. My ongoing theory is they recognize the importance of HR, but they don't want HR or marketing, because marketing equally can be the carrier of culture for a company. So they, because the focus is on the deal, they don't want anything to distract or any of the reasons why this deal shouldn't be done. And what I always say is, bringing me in or your HR person, ideally both, earlier in the conversation helps you identify, here are the things that we need to think about. These are the things we need to be ready for. Day one isn't the day you announce. Day one is the day you start thinking of doing this merger or acquisition, because you automatically start to make decisions through a different lens. Your filter now is, huh, how will this impact if we do a merger or an acquisition? So the moment you start thinking about it, you need to involve the person or team, but you know, usually particularly early on, you only want a few people to know, but the sooner you bring in that HR leader, you can anticipate so many of the challenges that can derail the success of the deal taking off, you know, from the moment it's announced. And this isn't just the compensation and the work benefits and all of that. Those questions better be answered. But it's even like, what's the org structure look like? How will departments be organized? You know, the longer you leave key critical questions open and you don't communicate it in a way that people understand what their role is, what the purpose of the deal is. And that's why an HR and a marketing leader can be critical to making sure you're on the right path for the moment you announce.
That's a great point. And I mean, anytime you talk to a valuation expert or a CPA or a banker, and they're focused around any kind of exit strategies, they will say you got to start that conversation and start thinking about your company as a potential, you know, acquired company, you know, at least a couple years early. Right. Absolutely. And so what happens? We start focusing on compliance and making sure we have all the regulations taken care of. And we get a full blown traditional auditor versus our family friend who's a bookkeeper or whatever. Right. And it's all the financials. But the HR conversation isn't happening 2 years early. Right. It's not even happening maybe 2 months before the actual transaction takes place. And so it's got to be part of that early conversation for sure. I'm curious about your thoughts around, because there's different types of organizations that go through M&A. There are those, you know, startup companies that are VC backed, where their purpose, their goal is to be taken out, right? It's to be acquired. Then you've got companies that are, like you said earlier, that are focused, you know, that are more mature, that a PE firm is going to, you know, take them out longer term. Do you see any difference in terms of the mindset, the approach to an exit, whatever that exit might be, among earlier stage companies versus those that are more mature?
Where I've seen, and I haven't done quantitative research on this, so I'm giving you just anecdotal perspective. It's really where I see some distinction is culture. So culture is a common thread, big or small business. Culture's there. People don't even realize often that their company has a certain kind of culture until someone from the outside comes in and says, here are the elements of culture of your company. But where I've seen the distinction is in a big company, you have an overarching culture. But then, particularly if it's a multinational, you'll have country cultures that influence. You could even have regional. Let's use the United States as an example, right? Americans, people can typically spot us when we travel abroad. Oh, you're American, right? So you have a common culture. But even within the United States, right, you have a north-south distinction. You know, someone from Texas sounds and thinks differently than someone from New York. You know, so you have to recognize that happens in a company as well. And I always joke, you can have the, you know, north-south influence in a company, but you can even have it come down to department, right? Anyone who's ever worked with engineers knows engineers approach everything the same way, right? Very different than a marketer, you know? So, but you have that, you have those influences. Then your smaller mid-market companies, oftentimes the culture is set by the founder, by the owner. I've worked a lot with manufacturing companies most recently. There's been a lot of merger and acquisition activity in manufacturing. And some of these manufacturing companies have been around for decades, generations, right? They started and the founder's long since passed, but he or she still has a culture that survives and thrives. And so for me, the difference, the common issue is often not appreciating the power of culture in a company, but then also not understanding the distinction and how that can play a role when you are going through a merger and acquisition. How do you bring those cultures together in a way that amplifies the best of both?
And now a short word from our sponsor. If you're a baseball fan like me, you're thrilled that the season is finally back in full swing, and you know how incredibly important it is to field the best team. And not just a team of pitchers, outfielders, or catchers. You need a well-rounded, multifaceted team with a stellar work ethic and strong skills, both technically and culturally, to truly drive results across your organization. Now, most companies don't have the resources of a Major League Baseball team, nor do they have a team of scouts that spend all day, every day, just recruiting new players. That's where Turning Point Executive Search comes in. With over 100 years of combined experience, our team of talent scouts knows where to go and how to attract MVP caliber candidates for every industry and company size across the U.S. Plain and simple, our placements make a huge impact. So let us help you build a world-class team. And now, back to the conversation. One of the things I've seen rising to the top of the conversation is, you know, showing up as an employee and as a leader, as a whole person. And mm-hmm. I think it really speaks to your point about humanizing M&A, because you can't just consider your people, right? And you also can't consider your leader as just a number or just a title or, you know, a nameplate on a wall someplace. They are a whole person, you know, with all the social issues and different lenses that they bring to the table as well. And I think, you know, one of the things I like about what you're talking about is that if more companies, at least in my naive opinion, if more companies looked at it more kind of from a bottom-up approach, they'd be probably surprised by some of the great ideas that can come up, you know, from the lower level or mid-level folks in their organization around M&A. Hey, what can we do to shore up our business? What can we do to become, you know, more marketable or more attractive to an organization? How can we streamline operations? All those things are only going to help the organization. You don't have to follow all of the advice, but I think if you allow your people to show up as a whole person, as a human being, then you get to tap into all those great ideas and experiences that you as a leader unilaterally may not have access to.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting when that comes up in the workshops that I do with senior executives. So we'll talk about the personalities. We've chatted a little bit about that. And I have the 10 personas in my book. One of the personas I talk about is the former rock star. And the former rock star is pretty consistently one of the characters that I've seen in every merger or acquisition. It's that person who was a rock star in your company. The challenge for them is that when the metrics for success change, which they inevitably do, they automatically do, you know, it's why I say the first myth is never say nothing's changing, because it's already changed. So that's just the reality. But for a rock star, when the metrics for success change, they have to pivot. And oftentimes he or she can have a very difficult time because they've got a formula. What made them successful against those original metrics may not be the right approach for this next set of metrics. And so it's interesting, just building on what you said is, you know, don't be surprised if you see people who were rock stars struggle, right? Here, we work through, here's ways to help former rock stars become rock stars again. But what I emphasize is be open to new rock stars rising to the occasion, because now you've got a different set of metrics. So someone who you might not have even appreciated had a skill set that it was absolutely crucial to your way forward, now he or she can rise. So I'm always encouraging leadership to create, foster that, create an environment where people feel comfortable that they can now rise to the occasion. And when you see people who you hadn't expected to do well, continue, you know, highlight, acknowledge that Joe's done a phenomenal job, and highlight something that, you know, people would never have even appreciated was critical to the success of the company moving forward, but now is. Because the more you do that, you'll have more and more people feeling, oh, I can do that. I can contribute in that way. It really can help accelerate the success of your deal moving forward.
Yeah, exactly. It really sets the tone, right? It's like anything else that goes on in your company, right? Your employees, whether you like it or not, they're looking to you as the leader, not only in what you say, but how you say it, how often do you say it? Are you just setting up a new DEI program, but that person doesn't really have much say? They don't have that seat at the table, right? It's just kind of a check the box kind of initiative. Or is the CEO really spending time talking about, hey, you know what? We realize we have an issue here. We need to do a better job of creating a more diverse workforce, not only in terms of, you know, traditional diversity definitions, but also diversity of thought. And if the CEO, the leader, the board, all those folks, and even departmental heads, if they are truly kind of walking that talk, so to speak, then it's much more likely that you'll see some change. Otherwise, it's going to be more kind of status quo, if you will. And to that point, you've been in manufacturing, as you talked about, you know, with a lot of manufacturing clients. You were in advertising early in career, and then obviously in technology. Do you observe any kind of change in the way that leaders are leading, given what's happened in the broader macro scale today?
I do. I'm really hoping it's a sweeping trend, but right now it's just glimmers of hope. The pandemic, and I always look for silver linings, so I'll be upfront about that. I'm an optimist too. There is a recognition that we need to focus on people. We need to focus not only on their mental health, but how do we help support their productivity? You know, you have all of the discussions about remote work and collaboration, but I don't think I've ever seen so much discussion about how do we help our workforce be better? How do we support that as opposed to just, you know, assuming everybody can work at the same rate, at the same pace, we're just going to continue. That's the joke about, yes, going back to the new normal. Let's just keep doing, let's go back to the way we used to do things. There's no going back. And so what has been encouraging for me to see is, and I think the pendulum keeps swinging back and forth between who has the power, right? Is it the employer or employee? You know, depending on the day, I feel like that moves back and forth. But what I've seen is a consistent trend is a greater focus on compassionate leadership, the value of emotional intelligence, and having an empathetic mindset when leading your people, particularly through what has been a prolonged state of uncertainty. You know, what I say is, we talk about a prolonged uncertainty. We need to just embrace uncertainty. It's here to stay. Like gone are the days. We can't, frankly, if we were open about it, we can't ever say we had it. We never had certainty.
True.
I mean,
the pandemic is it just amplified and shown a spotlight on it. But it was, we were kind of fooling ourselves.
I keep saying let's stop talking about navigating uncertainty. Let's embrace it. Just acknowledge that this is kind of the status quo. And then how do you lead people through that? How do you better support your workforce through that time, or that consistent time? Because it's a new model of leadership.
Exactly. And I think people really forget, because, you know, Americans especially, but on a global basis, but especially in America, we have very short-term memories. We don't remember how difficult things are. Or, I mean, even people from the early days of 2020, they forget how uncertain and completely unpredictable the whole world was. Nobody knew what was going on, right? Any TV show you watch now or series where it takes place in 2020, you'd watch it and you think, oh, that's right. That was our reality. It wasn't make-believe, right? And I think people really need to remember that, you know, we've all pretty much worked the same way for 100 years, the same, you know, manufacturing-driven approach to business and leadership. And, you know, I keep joking that my next book is going to be called Without a Building, right? Because everything from education to work is now devoid of requiring a physical building space. Education happens online, you know, therapy happens online, work happens online or virtually, right? You don't need that physical building. But for 100 years, that's what we all did. We equated work with a physical building, right? And now it's kind of gone out the window, literally, or the virtual window. But at the same time, leadership has to change and adjust to that. And I think, you know, similar to what you're talking about with your personas, there are some leaders that are those former, you know, rock stars that just don't want to change and don't understand how to adjust the new, as you said before, the new normal, but this kind of this reality that we're in today.
You know, it's interesting. I know we bonded over this. You know, I'm sure you see it even as a executive recruiter, the type of person that you recruit coming into, if the company is going through a merger and acquisition, or you know it's going to happen, it's a different skill set.
Very much so.
You have a leader, who has gone through it, who understands, it's a different ball game when you are leading people through that time. And I emphasize that because what I've seen oftentimes, particularly with boards, I've done a lot of talking in front of board, you know, whether board associations or boards themselves. The seductive leader is the one in my book, the dominatrix, the bully. And, you know, you don't think of them as a bully, but they're the ones who get things done. They are myopically focused on the objectives and the strategies. They can be incredibly powerful and successful in the short term. The tricky part is in the long term, they can really undermine the success of your transition, because if they have led using fear as the operating emotion, right? People don't deliver their best. They burn out or they leave. And so I'll say there's a role for that person, but be smart. Make sure that you incentivize them equally around how do they collaborate, you know, and have the team come to solutions as opposed to just dictating and not allowing for contrasting thought, for, you know, not challenging thought, because that's how collaboration, that's how innovation happens. And so a lot of the conversations I'll have are, you know, this new leadership model, here are the things you need to be aware of. You know, the old leadership style can be seductive, but at the same time, here are the trade-offs of going with that. So, you know, that's why your role is so critical. You've got to find the right personality at the time of where that company is in its journey.
Interesting. Yeah, no, I agree completely. And I think, you know, one of the things that we talk a lot about is groupthink. You know, on the recruiting side, you know, companies will inevitably come to us and say, I need a new VP of marketing. I need a new head of sales, a new, you know, COO. And they'll say, here are our competitors and we want somebody from a competitor. And in some cases, certainly, depending upon the situation, it makes sense to bring somebody in from that same sector. But in many cases, I will ask the question, well, tell us about the makeup of your team right now. And, you know, by and large, most of the team members are already from that industry, from that same space. And I think leaders don't intentionally, you know, go out there and say, I want to create an echo chamber or I want to create a homogenous right. company. But the way they go about hiring and training people, it really does foster that, where they're bringing people in from the same background, the same, you know, the same cut from the same cloth. And that group think, that echo chamber inevitably, you know, emerges because there's no true diversity of thought coming in from a different industry. And so to your point, I agree 100% about that for sure.
You know, it's interesting. You mentioned the diversity of thought, not just the standard definition of diversity. And it's why I'm so thankful for my time in advertising. I was 15 years in advertising. I worked with people who had been in the military, you know, magazine editors, philosophers, anthropology majors, art majors. What I loved particularly, and you know, I'm not in advertising now. But friends of mine who still are say that you have to attract that diversity of thought. That's how you get big ideas. And so I'm thankful for those 15 years because I appreciate the benefit of that diversity of thought. It's how you think differently. And so I love the fact that you emphasize it. And it's I was thinking to myself, I almost take it for granted because I had that as foundational to the work I did, the first 15 years of my life.
Well, and you mentioned earlier that you consider yourself to be very optimistic, and it comes across very obviously in the work that you do and just the passion that you have as well. And I think you need to have that. You need to have kind of that approach to life and that mindset as well. So let me ask you, so beyond being optimistic, how else do you describe yourself? How do you categorize, you know, your approach to life and business?
Well, I loved your description of yourself, practical optimist. I probably wouldn't have thought, well, what would be my label unless you had shared yours?
Sure.
And probably the thing that struck me, I'll always go with, what was the first thing I thought of was humble challenger. I would say humility. We talked a little bit about, I'm originally from the Midwest. I think it's just kind of part of the Midwestern values.
Definitely.
I also say my parents were very, they weren't humble necessarily. I mean, my mom was a fashion model. My dad was a French businessman.
Oh, wow.
They were always very intentional in saying, you know, that's not, don't ask, act grandiose, right? The power of connecting with people is being humble, approaching things from a learning standpoint. I think my dad in particular had that as his energy because he was French, right?
Sure.
So coming, learning English, learning about the culture. So thankfully that was just part of my core DNA. And then the challenger part, my parents were nonconformists. You know, my mom was a model, then a personal branding consultant. My dad was in international sales, also an entrepreneur. So I think seeing that within my parents kind of challenging the system. And my dad was always the type that would say, don't complain about the problem, fix it. Mm-hmm. And so I find that humble challenger probably off the top of my head is the best description for me.
I love that. That's probably one of my favorites that I've heard so far. I think I've talked to 15 people, and I always ask the same questions so far on the podcast. And I'm always impressed and amazed by the different combinations that people come up with. But I like that, especially. I mean, you know, when you think about someone who grew up with a mom who was a model, right, fashion model, you don't think about being humble or humility. You think about their whole role, their whole purpose, right, is to be in the spotlight, literally and physically. And so to have your mom really espouse, you know, for you and your sister, the importance of being humble and the importance of having humility, that's amazing. That's really impressive.
Well, I thank her for that. And I wrote a LinkedIn article about it that kind of took off. And essentially the message was things aren't always as they appear. My parents did divorce when I was 12. So she was a single mom for a while, but
sure.
She would do these glamorous photo shoots. And I remember there was a day where a kid in my class said his dad had seen my mom in a magazine for, I think it was like an air jet, you know, smart jets mm-hmm. at the time. She looked glamorous. And the kid had said, his dad said, wow, you know, she's got a glamorous mom. So I said this to my mom. Oh, you know, Joey's dad thinks you're glamorous. And she's like, oh, wish he'd been around when I bounced a check last week. But it was true, right?
That's great. Yeah, right.
You can have a perception of people that isn't true. And I grew up recognizing don't judge people by how things appear on the outside, because there could be a whole litany of things happening on the inside that you aren't even aware of. And so that's why for me, the humility piece is important, because it forces you to not make assumptions, you know, come with an open mindset.
Well, to that point, so let me challenge you a bit if I can. So to that point, your 10 personas, right? And everybody likes to think in terms of, and even on the recruiting side, I talk to a candidate, their background is finance. Okay, they're now in my CFO box. Talk to somebody who's got great sales experience, they're now in my CSO box, whatever. So of those 10 personas, I would imagine there's a fair amount of crossover, right? Yep. Nobody is purely, you know, the dominatrix or the bully or purely the former rock star. Do you see a lot of that blending depending upon the situation, kind of how they show up from day to day?
Yes. And more often than not, and that's why the introduction to that section, I'll say one, you know, these are caricatures. It's not to make fun of them, but I wanted to bring these personalities to life. Secondly, people can actually move in and out of these personas, exactly as you said, depending on the situation. I'll say during the M&A journey, because it is a journey, you might see a different side of people throughout. So this is not to judge. It is simply to help you identify why that person might be showing up that way. What are some of the external influences that are causing that? And then how can you either be a better leader? Now that you've identified how that person's showing up and why, how can you be a better leader to them? And oh, by the way, how do you not become one of these personas? Because, you know, at the end of the day, you're trying to bring the best out in people. And so really that section is all about helping not only identify what drives those behaviors, but how to help people, you know, maybe not have the fear and uncertainty and everything that may not bring out the best version of them.
I agree. It's very similar to the Strengths Finder, right? It's yes. meant to be a tool for leaders to figure out, okay, so what is the makeup of my team? And to have a common language where if everybody in the company or a certain department is doing the Strengths Finder, and I know that my peer to the right of me is more of a woo person or a connected person, and I'm more linear or more of a driver or what have you. And or me as a boss, as a leader, know that my team is going to have different personas also. It if you use it the right way, right, the way it's meant to be used, then it's going to be a great tool for you in your toolbox, as you said earlier on, to really help you become a better leader and to not lead with the same, you know, kind of one size fits all, paint everybody with the same brush, but instead have a little more of that personalized, you know, leadership focus.
Right. Yeah.
Great. So what does an M&A whisperer, an author, a global speaker do in her time off or just to kind of break away and kind of get refreshed, if you will?
So thankfully, and again, because I don't want to really aggravate people who are going through snow in the Midwest right now. Since moving to Phoenix, I have really come to appreciate the outdoors, just to be able to walk in nature. I think again, and I feel like, God, I keep tying things back to the pandemic, but one of the things that was reinforced in the pandemic was people getting out into nature, the ability to just have some calm and some clarity. I started to appreciate it then. And now I have the ability to walk my dog. I have a Watson, a Rhodesian Ridgeback that my husband and I adopted a couple years ago. And it's just wonderful to be in the mountains, cactus all around you, and able to, it truly, it's why Steve Jobs said emphatically, he did his best work. He'd always make people walk with him. You know, walking just stimulates the brain in a different way.
Exactly. Right. It does get you out of your norm and kind of the confines of your office and your thought process.
Yeah. If I'm stuck when I'm writing articles, if I'm stuck on a passage or stuck on how to end something, walking inevitably helps me think it through. The answer comes to me.
I agree. I love that. That's what it's all about. And I think, obviously we're very fortunate that we have that ability. I have, speaking of being, kind of humble and vulnerable, one of the things I write about in my book where, there are days where I just get stressed just beyond belief, running a business, having a team, feeling the obligation and responsibility to that team when things are not going well. And there's been times where I just, take my dog, his name is Xavier, we call him X, right? And we go down to the beach and we just sit in the car and I don't have music on. I turn my phone off for half an hour or so. Windows are open and I'm literally just focusing on listening to the waves, right? Now, I'm fortunate I live by the beach, but regardless, whatever element, whatever environment you need to get out of and get into to just shake things up. And, it doesn't solve all your problems. You don't come back to your office after the beach and think, oh, great, life is all hunky-dory now. But you have a different perspective and you've given your mind a chance to kind of daydream and kind of, get out of that mode and be more creative and come up with some other solutions.
Right. And absolutely. And it's not that I didn't appreciate it before. I now simply have an opportunity and force myself to do it, right? Get outside, walk the dog, be part of it. Cause I've seen the benefits firsthand, exactly as you shared your own experience.
I have one last question for you. And this is, obviously we're both similar amount of experience, similar age and stage of life. So you today versus you, coming up with J. Walter Thompson and Cohn before that at the other marketing agency, what would you tell yourself back then, knowing what you now know? And more importantly, what would you share with any early career professionals out there?
So first, and it's here's what's so funny. So Ken, I wrote a LinkedIn article about why I hate the question, hey, what would older self tell younger self?
Sure.
It's a great question.
No, it's a good point. Yeah.
Here's why. Because younger self would never listen to the older version of me. That's
true.
That's
a very good point. Yes. That's an important caveat to that scenario.
Your parents will tell you, don't make the same mistakes I did. You need to make the same mistakes. Otherwise you don't appreciate it.
Yeah, right. Right. Exactly. And you're not necessarily listening or hearing what you're being told anyway at that age. Yeah, true.
And my older self would sound so sage and so wise, and my younger self would have been like, "You're full of it. That's not going to happen. I'm all good.
Thanks for the advice, but leave me alone."
But what I would say, something I have appreciated later in life, and I guess I didn't realize it because I'm a planner, right? Mm-hmm. I knew I was going to go to Thunderbird at the age of 8. I was going to be ambassador to France. I had all these, and look at me.
Yeah, right.
But I would say be open to serendipity, allow opportunities for serendipity to happen, right? Be open to possibilities. My career is a perfect demonstration of that. I mean, I've created a role in mergers and acquisitions. I started out wanting to be ambassador to France, got into advertising and marketing, and now I consult, Fortune 500 and middle market and small mid-market company leadership on here's how to navigate mergers and acquisitions and lead your people through it. This job didn't exist when I was back in college and graduate school. So I say just plan, absolutely plan, because it helps you be prepared for for opportunities and possibilities, but then also be open to the possibilities. Don't let them pass you by.
And it's the same advice that you were talking about earlier, giving to CEOs of companies that are going through an exit, an M&A activity, right? You have to realize that your people, some people are going to pivot very well and very quickly. Others are going to be very closed off to any kind of pivot or anything that's going to detract from whatever their you know, expected path is going to be. Same thing when you're in your 20s or even in your 30s, right? Be open to that. Be open to that pivot. It may not be what you expected. It may be, you know, painful for a while, but you never know where it's going to take you, right? I mean, we always say in recruiting that things happen for a reason, but you don't always know what that reason is right away. It might take 6 months or a year or 5 years, but then you can look back and say, oh, if I had gotten that job over there, I wouldn't have done this. It wouldn't have led me to this over here. I wouldn't have had a chance to do all these great things. So be open to that, right? Don't be so focused or overly committed to one thing that you don't allow yourself for other flexibility and other pivots to occur.
And it's a philosophy I've transferred to a lot of things. I had the opportunity to do a TEDx talk last year, and I was asked what was the number one lesson you learned doing a TEDx talk, and I said being open to feedback. The idea that I had for that talk at the beginning transformed and morphed. I had an entire outfit made for it. I became an exotic bird because that was a through line in my talk about my M&A journey. And I never, not that, that definitely was not an idea that I had at the beginning for that talk, but where it ended up was because I was open to feedback. So it's a philosophy that transcends a lot of parts of your life.
That's great. Well, I think a lot of us are going to now pull up your TED talk and see this.
it's about embracing uncertainty.
So I love it. I love it. That's
watch
great.
And figure out what the hell is she talking about?
Exactly. Wonderful.
What does that mean?
So aside from looking at the TED talk, where else can people get a hold of you? I really encourage people, as I've said many times to other folks as well, to read your book. I think even if you're not going through an M&A transaction, it's very eye-opening because it gives you a good glimpse into what your employees are like, what they're thinking. They may not know what you as a leader have as a long-term strategy for your company, but understanding, again, like StrengthsFinder, understanding what your team is comprised of, who they're comprised of, that's going to help you as a better leader. So Now What is the book? And I think it was a great read. I really enjoyed it. So, but how can people find you?
You know, by the way, just on the book, I've been surprised at how many people who aren't in mergers and acquisitions. I've had nurses and teachers who read my book and who
Oh, wow.
Read you on Amazon, the personas in particular. Yeah. This is who I'm working with. Thank you so much. Help me understand her.
I love it.
So I hang out a lot on LinkedIn. I write not just on mergers and acquisitions. I've written a number of posts. My mom passed away in March of 2020 during the pandemic. So I write lessons she taught me as a model, which thankfully I've received a lot of love and adoration, as much as you can have that on social media. I get a lot of positive feedback. And then my website, jenniferjfondrevay.com. You'll find out about the speaking and the consulting that I do.
Wonderful. Well, thank you for sharing all these great insights. It's, I mean, every time you and I connect, I always pull something away from it. I take notes, which is wonderful. And I love that humble challenger, you know, persona that you described for yourself. You got to come up with some kind of an illustration for your own persona going forward.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for sharing. It was great talking to you today.